Heichel Menachem presents A Tale of Two Souls, an ongoing lecture series on the Tanya by Rabbi Yosef Yitzchok Jacobson. This is tape number 61 in the series entitled Three Levels of Intimacy, Part 1, recorded live at Heichel Menachem, Brooklyn, New York, on the 28th of Shvat, 5759.
Morning. We are up to the 23rd chapter of Tanya. There's a story told about the Hasidic master, the holy Reb Yisrael of Ruzhin, that once upon arrival to a specific city, they offered him hospitality in two homes, giving him the option of either of the homes. Both were populated by wealthy Jews, by affluent Jews. But there was a major difference between them. The first Jew was not so pious. He was known to be not so meticulously observant and religious. There were various rumors circulating about him. But on the other hand, he was honest with himself. He didn't put on a holy face. He was a genuine human being. He was humble and he was good-natured. The other Jew was also very wealthy, but extremely religious, observant, pious. He was one of those perfect Jews, quote-unquote. But on the other hand, he was very proud of himself. He was very proud of the fact that he was the perfect religious Jew. The Ruzhiner chose the former and rejected the latter's home. And the people close to him were quite astonished. They couldn't understand why. It didn't seem befitting. It seemed that the Rebbe should stay in the latter's home. So the Ruzhiner said, "What don't you understand? This Jew might be pure, totally pure from all sins, unblemished, but he's arrogant." And our sages tell us, as I mentioned last week, what the Gemara says, that Hashem says, "I cannot coexist with an arrogant human being in one home." Zog de Ruzhiner, if Hashem doesn't find this Jew's home a place where he can dwell, so I certainly can't dwell there. If Hashem doesn't feel comfortable there, then I can't feel comfortable there. The other Jew, he says, might have violated some sins in his life, but he's not arrogant. The pasuk tells us, "Hashoichin itam b'soich t'moisam." Hashem says, He dwells with them, with the Jewish people, in the midst of their impurity. Hashem dwells with them in their impurity. So the Ruzhiner says, if Hashem can dwell with this Jew in his home, then I can also find my dwelling in this Jew's home. Now the truth is that in light of what we will learn in chapter 24 of the true definition of an avera, of a sin, the story is not totally appropriate. But nonetheless, it does convey to us some of the perspective of chassidus on what arrogance is. There's a story I once heard about the Alshech. Reb Moshe Alshech, 16th century great master, thinker, writer, who wrote the Torah Moshe on the Chumash. And the Alshech was a student of the Arizal. And the Alshech would give his own classes, which were very unique. The Alshech had a style that's articulated in his Svarim, in the Alshech's commentary on the Tanakh. And once it was Parshas Chayisara, they were reading the Torah portion of Chayisara. And the Alshech was giving a lecture, a speech, saying Torah on this Parsha. And who came to listen to him? None other than the Arizal himself. The master Kabbalist, Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, considered one of the greatest Kabbalists in Jewish history, came to listen to the Alshech. The Alshech was discussing and expounding upon the story in the beginning of Parshas Chayisara, where Sarah, our first mother, Avraham Avinu's wife, passes on to the next world, and Avraham engages in a meticulous negotiation with Ephraim the Chittite, to sell to him the Ma'aras HaMachpelah, the cave of Machpelah in Hebron, where he can inter the body of Sarah Imenu. And the Torah discusses the exact negotiations and conversations and exchange between Avraham Avinu and Ephraim the Chittite, until Ephraim was willing to sell him that piece of land, and Avraham purchased it and he buried Sarah there. And now Alshech was expounding on this episode, on this story. The Arizal was sitting and listening. In middle, the Arizal stood up and he left. You can imagine how the Alshech felt. The Alshech was in the middle of speaking, was in the middle of communicating his spiritual thought, his Torah wisdom. And in middle, his Rebbe leaves. The Alshech was devastated. He was broken. So right after he went to the Arizal's home, he walks and he says, Rebbe, why did I deserve this? What have I done? Why did the Rebbe leave in the middle? So the Arizal says, I'll tell you. You spoke about Parshas Chayisara. So who was there at your class? Who was there? Avraham Avinu was there, the soul of Avraham Avinu. The soul of Sarai Imenu was there. Ephraim the Chittite was there. All the people involved in the story, all of their souls came to listen to you. In the middle of the speech, you were overtaken by your ego. You experienced a certain sense of satisfaction, a bit of arrogance. So Sarai Imenu left. Avraham Avinu left. The only one that remained was Ephraim, and I didn't want to stay there alone with Ephraim, so I also left. And this was the key point that Alter Rebbe taught us at the conclusion of the 22nd chapter of Tanya. What is the definition, the true definition of gasus haruach, of arrogance? In the Alter Rebbe's words, the fact that nechshav ledavar b'fnei atzmai nifrid mekdushas shel makom, man considers himself an independent existence detached from the sanctity of Hashem. In other words, what is the Alter Rebbe saying? You want to know what arrogance is? Entertaining the idea that you're not holy. That's what arrogance is. You believe that you're separated from the holiness of Hashem. And when you think about it, it's an extraordinary way of defining arrogance. How would you usually define arrogance? Someone asks you, what does it mean? How would you define an inflated ego, an unhealthy ego, an arrogant human being? Somebody who thinks of himself or herself too much. Zagdal Tereba, no, you know what arrogance means? That you think of yourself too little. You don't realize that you're one with Hashem's holiness. Zagdal Terebbe, don't rob yourself away from the deepest gift and treasure. The reality of your truth, of your reality, is Hashem Echad, the one God. Arrogance means Nifrit Mekdushas Yishal Makim. I define myself as an unholy creature. I define myself as somebody detached from Hashem, as a self-centered, self-oriented, self-directed, self-absorbed creature. That definition of self is untrue. You're holy. You're not just holy. The truth of your existence is the intimacy, the deepest intimacy of Hashem's reality. It's just, as Dr. Eb explained in the beginning of the chapter, that Hashem's all-pervading presence is concealed, and this concealment allows for an ego. If there wouldn't be a concealment, it would be obvious that the truth of my reality is Hashem's intimate presence. But the concealment allows for a self-contained and isolated perception of self. It allows for that perception to emerge and to dictate our behavior. But in truth, the whole ego thing is a delusion. It stems from a cover-up. There's no such a thing as an I. My I is one with the sanctity of Hashem. It's a conduit for the divine I. The Baal Shem Tov once interpreted homiletically the words of Moshe. In Parshas Vaschanan, I believe, Anoichi oimed ben Hashem ubeinechem. I stand between Hashem and you. And homiletically, the Baal Shem Tov interpreted this pasuk to mean, I stand between Hashem and you, that it is the I, the anoichi, the I, the sense of self, the sense of ego, that creates the division between Hashem and you. It's the anoichi, the unhealthy sense of an inflated ego, which I made, which stands in the way to separate between Hashem and Beinechem. In the natural scheme of things, there's no separation whatsoever. Every nuance and crevice of my life is filled with the divine identity. What the ego does is it substitutes my real self with a perception of a fake self, which constructs a whole personality of its own, but in essence doesn't possess a true identity. That's not the real I. It's a fake I. It's a substitute. It's masquerading the real I. And this is, Dr. Rebbe put it in the end of 22, is defined in the Zohar as Turei Depruda, peaks, mountains of separation. Last week there was a lot of discussion about it, so I looked it up in Zohar. It's in Zohar, Parshas Vayetze, Daf Kuf Nun Ches. The Zohar quote says that in Shir HaShirim, in Shleim HaMelech, Song of Songs, two types of mountains are mentioned. In Perek Beis, in the second chapter of the Song of Songs, he talks about Harei Baser. Harei Baser means mountains of separation, mountains of divisiveness. In chapter 8, at the end of Shir HaShirim, he talks about Harei Psamim, mountain of spices. In both of them, he says, he describes the gazelles and the deers that run on these mountains. Zog de Zayar, that there are two types of mountains. There's Harei Psamim, the mountain of spices, which is interpreted as Har HaMiriah, the Haramayriyo, the place where the Beis HaMikdash stood. And then there is Harei Baser, which the Zohar says are Turei Depruda, the mountains of separation. So there are those mountains that define, that constitute the element of separation. Now this explanation in the definition of arrogance, that I define myself as unholy, as detached from Hashem's all-pervading holiness. That's what it means. This is a consequence and a continuation in Tanya to what has been discussed at length in the previous chapters in 20 and 21, in the beginning of 22. What is the true definition of life? The Alter Rebbe explained that the true definition of life, the true definition of reality is all believe that Hashem is one alone, just as He was prior to the creation of the world, when He was one alone. There was no change as a result of creation. Creation doesn't constitute, according to the Alter Rebbe, even the slightest change in the chemistry of reality. Just as prior to creation, reality was defined as Hashem, now to post-creation, the chemistry of reality is identical and it hasn't changed. Reality remains the same. Hashem. there is a world, there is a huge world. And the Torah says that Hashem created a world, so the Alter Rebbe explained. The world has no reality save the divine speech that invigorates it continuously. Furthermore, that speech never left the speaker, which is Hashem. And thus, the speech which invigorates the world continuously is submerged within the intimate identity of Hashem. And just as in human speech, the Alter Rebbe said, when the word or the sentence is still absorbed within the emotions of the speaker, it doesn't occupy any data there, it doesn't occupy any space, it can't be deemed as a thing, even though it's there, it's totally submerged and nullified and drowned in the intimate emotions of the speaker. So this is also true concerning the cosmic reality. Since no space is devoid of Hashem's intimate self, so even though He uttered words and He created the worlds through these utterances, but the word is still absorbed within the identity of the speaker. And thus the word which invigorates the worlds continuously occupies no data in His presence, and it's as though it would be naught and nothing. It's totally submerged and unified with the intimate reality of Hashem. That is the only thing which you could define as a thing, as an existence. The word that invigorates the world is not a thing when it's submerged in the intimate emotion of the speaker. This was the key point of 20 and 21. But this is only one side of the coin. Hashem didn't just utter the word and created the world through it. He uttered the word and He allowed these words to be veiled, concealed, obscured, disguised, masked. He created the world by means of Him contracting Himself and contracting His creative energy and covering it, masquerading it with many garments and veils and coverings. The creation of the world entails an intense Hester Panim, concealment of the countenance of Hashem. His face, His inner intimate presence is not revealed. And therefore, every single world, every single universe, and all contained within it, that was created from these words of Hashem that is absorbed in the speaker, experiences itself as a reality. Experiences some level of self-consciousness because its creation is a product from what he defines as a tzimtzum, as a limitation, as a contraction, as a concealment. If there were no concealments, it would be evident and obvious that the word is absorbed in the speaker. So there's no reality outside of Hashem's intimate existence. But every single thing was created only post a tzimtzum. Hashem compressed, contracted, limited, disguised Him's all-pervading presence and the creative energy invigorating these worlds. And this creates a perception that the word left the speaker. And thus, the creations of this word have an identity outside of Hashem. And this sense of self-perception exists on many levels. In the higher worlds, there's a small concealment. In the lower worlds, there's a more powerful concealment. The more powerful the concealment, the more powerful the sense of separation and detachment. The less powerful the concealment, the less dense the cover-up, the less the sense of I, the more the sense of self-effacement and oneness with Hashem's intimate reality. But when this cover-up is very dense, so the creatures created by this creative energy which is covered feel themselves detached, disconnected. They feel that the word is disconnected. They feel themselves disconnected from the word until there is a concept called klipa, which is defined as elikim acherim, other gods that totally feel themselves as separated and distinct and independent of Hashem, and their ego becomes an awesome, pompous reality. How is that possible? It's possible only because of the cover-up. The cover-up that covers up what is reality. If the intimate eye of Hashem would be manifestly present, there would be no sense of separation. For in the presence of Hashem's eye, kamei in the Alter Rebbe's term, kamei, kula kamei, in the presence of Hashem's eye, all is submerged and absorbed and drowned within him. In the presence of the intimacy of the soul of the speaker, the spoken word is totally nullified and submerged. It doesn't possess any independent existence whatsoever. So if Hashem's eye was conspicuously present, all would appear as is, nothing. We would all behold emotionally, experientially, on all levels, we would behold that existence is to be defined exclusively as God. God is one, that's it. But creation entailed the concealment of that eye. True, from Hashem's perspective, the concealments are transparent, so everything still appears as is nothing. From Hashem's perspective, the concealments don't constitute a concealment, like he explained at the end of 21, that the veil itself is godly, and thus it doesn't obscure his vision, so to speak. So if that is the case, everything still appears as it truly is. Kula kamei kiloi chashiv. Everything is as though it doesn't exist. But that's from Hashem's perspective. However, our perspective is different. The world's perspective and our sense of identity is impacted and defined by the concealment of the inner eye of Hashem. So the world has an eye, save the divine eye. What defines it as a world is the fact that his eye is not present there. That's what makes the world a world. If his eye would be present there, the world could not experience itself as a world. It would experience itself totally submerged and nullified. The only reality would be Hashem Echad. What God is one. Hu Levad Yehu, He is one alone. So existence as we know it is a compromise of reality. It's a denial of truth. It's a denial of the truth of reality. The very notion of identity that is the hallmark of our existence. That's the name of the game. Identity is a cry out loud against the truth. The truth is that there is He and there is nothing besides He. Not because the world is an illusion. That's wrong. The world is not an illusion. Nowhere does the Alter Rebbe say that the world is an illusion and a hallucination and a fantasy and a dream. It's contrary to one of the foundational doctrines in the Alter Rebbe's thought that will be articulated in chapter 36. Not because the world is an illusion. Bereishis bara lekim es hashamayim v'saaretz is the beginning of Bereishis. In the beginning, Hashem created heaven and earth. But the question is, what is the meaning of the world? What is the significance of this reality? Does this reality have any significance? When the word is absorbed in the emotion, are you going to call the word a thing? Are you going to attribute to it existence? The only reality is Hashem is one, the intimate presence of Hashem. But life as we know it is an exercise in a major cover-up. The greatest cover-up experienced in all of history. The cover-up over Hashem's intimate eye. So life as we experience it, post-symptom, post-concealments, post-cover-ups, denies its true value. It denies it being nullified and submerged in ultimate reality in Hashem. So where does this leave us? Where do we go from here? What possibly can be the conclusions of this doctrine? Hence, chapter 23 comes the Alter Rebbe in Perek Chav Gimel and revolutionizes to us what Yiddishkeit is. The Alter Rebbe tells us that there is one product existing in our universe which comes from the pre-Tzimtzum space. Torah and mitzvahs. Torah and mitzvahs are an expression, are a manifestation, are an embodiment of Hashem's intimate eye. It is the only product which was not impacted by any type of concealment. Hashem did not conceal Himself to bring forth Torah and mitzvahs into being, because they constitute His intimate self. They are who He is in His very essence. According to Kabbalah and Chassidus, the true and deepest value of Torah and mitzvahs beyond everything, and Alter Rebbe discusses this in various discourses, is that it's Hashem's inner will and wisdom which is one with Him. On the deepest level, so to speak, Hashem wants Torah and mitzvahs. That's, so to speak, who Hashem is. Das is it. That's He. This is His very eye, His very essence. So in Torah and mitzvahs, Hashem's eye is manifestly present. So you know what Torah and mitzvahs are? They pierce through all the tzimtzumim. They breach all the walls. They tear down all the partitions. They cut through all the veils and penetrate all the masks. They bring to fore the truth, Hashem's inner eye. No masks, no disguises, no cover-ups. The raw truth of reality. That's Torah and mitzvahs. And in the presence of that eye, there is nothing outside of Him. The world is defined as a world as a result of the concealment of Hashem's eye. That's what makes the world a world. That's what gives it its identity. What makes Torah and mitzvahs, not the concealment of Hashem's eye. On the contrary, that is Hashem's eye. So Torah and mitzvahs is the one element existing within our lives in which Hashem's eye becomes manifestly present. Here we pierce through all of the stratums, all of the layers, all of the coverings. Hashem's eye is manifestly present in Torah and mitzvahs. So to live with Torah and mitzvahs means to live with the true world, to live with the true definition of reality, to live with the truth of the universe, to live with the oneness of Hashem, with the Hu Levadehu. Torah and mitzvahs means putting on Hashem's glasses, so to speak, assuming His point of view, viewing the world how it is viewed from the perspective of truth, Kameh, from Hashem's perspective. Mitzvahs and Torah means to treat and to view the world from the true perspective of what reality is, that He is one alone and there's nothing beside Him. A mitzvah gets you in touch with the truth of reality. A mitzvah means living the truth. That's the only experience we have in our life, in our world, where we can return to the truth of our reality. Where we can return to the pure place in which there's nothing separated from Hashem. Torah and mitzvahs allow us to reclaim ourselves. The world cries out, I am. A mitzvah cries out, God is one. Now true, Hashem is the one who made the world that way. Hashem is the one who made this tzimtzumim. That's true. That's what He wanted. The definition of the world is, Hashem wanted there should be a space where the creatures should experience themselves as separated from Him. That's what He desired. That's the definition of a world. He wanted to create a space where that space experiences itself in its own perception as distinct from Hashem. But what's the definition of Torah? He Himself. As a result of this, in the world of mitzvahs, in the world of Torah, there's no ego. There is total self-nullification. Since in mitzvahs, in Torah, there's only one eye, so in the experience of learning Torah and observing mitzvahs, there's no separation. There's no identity outside of Hashem's intimate identity. All identity of a self comes from concealment. In mitzvahs and Torah, there's no concealment. So the experience of performing a mitzvah and learning Torah entails total self-nullification, self-effacement in the presence of the truth. And in this experience of self-nullification, in Torah and mitzvahs, the Alter Rebbe will explain in chapter 23, three levels. There is that level where man becomes a carrier or a chariot for the soul of the world, for Hashem, where I become a what he calls a merkava, a chariot, a vehicle for Hashem. There is that level where man and the universe become not only a vehicle, but they become a body for Hashem, a body to the soul of the cosmos, to Hashem. And then there is that level where man and the universe merge and become one with Hashem in a seamless whole. And the first two are achieved through mitzvahs, and the third deepest level of intimacy is achieved only through Torah study. And the unique contribution of what a mitzvah is, and the first two levels of intimacy with Hashem will be dealt with in the first half of chapter 23. And then the third level of intimacy, which is achieved in the learning Torah experience, will be dealt with in the second half of chapter 23, which we will learn, God willing, next week. Now, this is a complicated chapter. It's a fascinating chapter, but it's a complicated one. It's difficult. So we have to remember this point throughout the entire chapter, because as you'll see, Dr. Rebbe is going to go into many details and various elements. But what is the foundation? What is the point? The point is one. And remember this so we don't have to repeat it again. In mitzvahs and Torah, there's no tzimtzum. There's no concealment. Through them, man grabs on, so to speak, the intimate self of Hashem without any cover-ups and concealments. So in the life of Torah and mitzvahs, man lives the truth. He lives the truth that there is he and there is nothing else besides he. Doing a mitzvah is creating an explosion of Hashem's oneness in this universe. One second. That's what we'll finish with, the others being in recovery. 1 second. Im kalanal, in light of all that has been said above, yuvon v'yivur heitiv b'teis v'zbir, we can better understand and more fully and clearly elucidate Masha amru b'zayar, the statement in the Zayar, deraisa v'kutshabrichu kulachat, that the Torah and Hashem are entirely one. U'b'tikunim pirshu, and in the Tikkuni Zayar, they have explained that the Ramach Pikud, that the 248 commandments, mitzvahs, Inun Ramach Evarin de Malka, they are the 248 organs of the King, of the Divine King. In light of all of the above that has been explained about the true nature and meaning of Hashem's unity, and the reasons for our lack of perception of that unity, that will allow us to truly understand the idea, the soul behind these major Kabbalistic statements in the Zohar, that the Torah and Hashem are entirely one, and the mitzvahs are considered the organs of the King. And as the Alter Rebbe will explain in the continuation of this chapter 23, the connection between the doctrine that he has established in the previous chapters and how that allows us to truly understand these statements in the Zayah. The point being here in Zayah, that Torah and mitzvahs are mamish unified with Hashem beyond the unity of anything else we talk about in reality. It's only about Torah that we say, it's entirely one with Hashem. And it's only about mitzvahs, which we compare metaphorically, obviously, to the relationship of a body to a soul. That is the relationship of mitzvahs to Hashem. We say that the 248 mitzvahs correspond to the Ramach Evarim. That the Gemara says. The Gemara says at the conclusion of Masechta Makos that there are 613 mitzvahs, the 248 positive and 365 prohibitions, loisasa and essay, ramach essay and chasal loisasa, the 248 correspond to the evarim shalad, to the 248 organs of the human being. But the tikkuni zayar in tikkun lamed takes it a step further and calls the mitzvahs ramach evarim de malka, that they are the 248 organs of the King. Now, obviously, that is that is we use over here anthropomorphical terms, applying human attributes to the divine reality. The Alter Rebbe will soon explain what the metaphor is, but the idea is that there is a very powerful connection and unity between the mitzvahs and Hashem, similar to the relationship between the organs of one's body and his soul. So the nature and the idea of this unity that characterizes Torah and mitzvahs uniquely, a unity with Hashem that does not exist in any other reality, will be understood as a result of what has been explained earlier, A. And B, in that itself, we see that there's a difference between Torah and mitzvahs. Concerning Torah, we say that it's one with Hashem, kul echad. Concerning mitzvahs, we don't say it's one with Hashem. It's the organs of Hashem. It's the organs of the King. Now, obviously, the body is intimately intertwined and interconnected with the soul, as we shall soon see. But nevertheless, we're dealing ultimately with two identities, two realities. We don't use the term kul echad. We say that it's the organs of the soul, it's the organs of the King, it's the organs of Hashem's reality, so to speak. So the Alter Rebbe begins explaining. Lefi. Does that mean to say that the Ramach Ivarim of a human being correspond to the Ramach Ivarim, the Malka? Yeah, that is true. Obviously, the analogy is totally incomplete. Our Ivarim are physical, and therefore are limited by physicality and mundaneness and so forth. The Ramach Ivarim, the Malka, are wholly abstract and spiritual, and don't have the definitions and limitations of our organs. But ultimately, our Ivarim come and evolve from the Ramach Ivarim de Malka after a very long, complex, and nuanced evolutionary process. They are embodiments and manifestations of Ramach Ivarim de Malka, and that's why the mitzvahs ultimately correspond to our Ramach Ivarim. But that's not the point here, huh? No, we are not now talking, we're talking about the Ramach Ivarim of Hashem, because Ramach Ivarim de Malka, the relationship of mitzvahs to Hashem, is similar to the relationship of the Aver to the Nefesh, as we shall soon see. And he begins discussing the idea of mitzvahs, the unity of mitzvahs with Hashem. Lefi, because Shah mitzvah is in Pnimi Yisratzen Ha'alyin v'cheftzei ha'amiti. Mitzvahs constitute Hashem's innermost will and His true desire. Hamalu bash b'chal ha'elemis. El Yahal Yainim Vitachtainim Lachayasam, which is clothed in all the upper and lower worlds, thereby giving them life. This Pnimiyas Haratzin, the innermost will and true desire, is manifest in all of the worlds, giving them vitality. Ki kol chayusam vishifa, talui b'maisa mitzvah shalatachtainim ki yadua. Because the very life and sustenance of all the worlds is dependent upon the performance of the mitzvahs by the creatures of the lower worlds, as is known. V'nimtza. It follows then, Shemaisa mitzvahs v'kiyuma, that the performance and fulfillment of the mitzvahs, hu levush hapnimi lepnimis ratzon elyon, is the innermost garment for the innermost aspect of Hashem's will. What does that mean? Shemimai says that since it is due to this performance of the mitzvah, which nimshach oir v'chayis ratzon elyon lislabish b'olamus, it's as a result of this performance of this maisa that the light, the energy, and life of the worlds issues forth from the divine will to be clothed and manifested in them. Mitzvahs, he says, are pnimiyas ratzon ha'elyon v'cheftzei ha'amiti. The Alter Rebbe explains elsewhere that will is a multi-layered and multifaceted reality. There is, by way of illustration, let's take our own lives. There is no act in the world which is not driven by will. The engine of every performance of man is his or her volition. But in will itself, there are many layers, many gradations and levels. There is a superficial will that is the direct fuel which is driving a specific act. But that superficial will contains within it a deeper will, which contains in it yet a deeper will, which in turn is the outgrowth of even a deeper and more essential will, and so on and so forth. For example, the truth is any aspect of life can be used for an example, but let's take a vivid, conspicuous example. A businessman who operates a business. At the course of his day, he does several things connected to the business, among others, obviously. First, he wakes up at an early hour. He commutes to his business. He answers telephone calls. He makes appointments and so forth. Why is he doing these things? Because he wants to do them. Will is the drive behind these activities, behind waking up early at an early hour, commuting, starting his car. Why is he starting his car? Because he wants to start his car. Because he wants to get up in the morning. Why is he picking up the receiver? Because he wants to answer the telephone. That is the will that is driving it. I want to now answer the telephone, so I answer the telephone. Is that it? Is that ultimately his essential will in life? No. That will contains a deeper will. Why does he want to do these things? Because he wants that his business should survive and prosper. And if I want my business to survive, if he wants his business to survive and prosper, he has to wake up at an early hour, get into the car, drive to his business, answer telephone calls, make appointments, and deal with other issues at hand. But is that it? Is that ultimately a will? Is that ultimately his final, ultimate purpose? Why does he want his business to survive and prosper? Why? He wants income and prestige. And this is what's going to bring him income and prestige. So at the core of the will that is to start the engine of the car, there is a deeper will which wants that the business should survive. At the core of that will, there is a deeper will which wants that he should have an income and status. And prestige. But why does a person want income, money, and status? Why? That's an outgrowth of yet a deeper will. And that is, he needs food, shelter, acceptance of his fellow man, supporting his family, and so forth. And indeed, why does he want all that? And here it boils down to the ultimate, most intrinsic will, most essential will intrinsic to every creature, the will to continue to exist. I want to exist. And in my perception, existence, continuation of my existence depends on all these factors. This does not mean that when the telephone is ringing in the business, before I pick up the receiver, I think, okay, why do I want to pick up the receiver? Because I want to answer the call. Why do I want to answer the call? Because I might be a customer. And I want my business to prosper. Why do I want my business to prosper? Because I want an income and prestige. Why do I want income and prestige? By the time you make all these calculations, that day will pass and another few days will pass. And as you say, the phone has long stopped ringing. So obviously that's not the case. But nevertheless, when he picks up the receiver, it's because he wants to do that. But nevertheless, that will is driven by deeper wills that are not necessarily surfacing at the conscious, and he has to meditate and contemplate upon them, but they are all there. This is a metaphor which is true concerning Hashem's relationship with his creation as well. Hashem is also involved in an enterprise, in a business. It's also a business that sometimes yields powerful profits and powerful losses. And the reason he creates a universe at every single moment, as we have discussed in Perek Chaf at length, that process is a continue, is that the creation is a continuous process, moment after moment after moment, and he is totally involved in every single aspect of it. And obviously the reason he does it is because he wants to do it. He wants to. That the will, the Ratzon Ha'Elyon, is the fuel that is driving him, kevayachal, so to speak, to create the world, to sustain it, to control it, to lead it, at every single moment of existence. But that will, ultimately, is an outgrowth of a deeper will. Why does he want the creation of the universe? Why does he want the continuous existence of the universe? Because he has a certain purpose. And what is, and that he wants that purpose. But why does he want that purpose? So from the Kabbalistic and Hasidic perspective, you trace it back all the way, and it boils down to mitzvahs. Mitzvahs are the pnimiyus ratzonalion v'cheftzei amiti. Hashem is in love with mitzvahs. Hashem is essentially connected with mitzvahs. And in order that mitzvahs should be implemented and fulfilled, that obviously requires a universe, and it requires that universe should have many components which shall allow for the performance of all the mitzvahs. So the Alter Rebbe is saying, mitzvahs are the pnimiyus ratzonalion v'cheftzei amiti. Obviously, everything else is also an outgrowth of ratzonalion and cheftzei. Ratzon is what translates into energy. The energy of the world is an embodiment of Hashem's will it should exist. Or to use the previous terminology used in the previous chapters, Hashem's utterances, Hashem's words, which are the energy of the universe, are an outgrowth of His will. So every aspect of the universe is a consequence and an embodiment of His will. But what is pnimiyus ratzonalion? What is cheftzei amiti? What is the true underlying, essential, innermost will that is driving all of this is the mitzvahs. The mitzvahs have a relationship with the most intimate aspect of Hashem. He is essentially connected. He's in love with the mitzvahs. He embraces them on the most intimate level. Hence, that results in a will, which results in a will, which results in a will, ultimately to create the universe and continuously to grant it vitality and energy. And that's why he says it's melubash b'chala olamos. That is ultimately enclosed in all the worlds, constantly sustaining it. And therefore their whole chayis is ultimately dependent on the maisa mitzvahs of the tachtainim. Because the moment that maisa mitzvahs of the tachtainim ceases, the superficial will has no validity anymore, it has no essence. For example, in the illustration of the businessman, true, when the telephone rings, he doesn't meditate upon his will to exist, or upon his innermost desire for prestige and status and acceptance of society and so forth. But when he comes to the realization that picking up that receiver, which is part of his business, is destroying his income, is destroying his business, ultimately the superficial will also ceases to exist. So this means, in other words, that the performance of the mitzvahs is the innermost garment for the innermost aspect of Hashem's will. What does it mean it's the innermost garment? It is the medium, the instrument, through which Hashem's innermost will is realized, is communicated, is expressed. Because Hashem really, really, on the most intimate level, wants the mitzvahs. So what is the garment? What is the levush? And over here he means garment, the tool which brings it to the fore, which expresses it, which draws it down, which communicates it. It's the ma'isa ha-mitzvahs. That is the innermost garment for the pnimiyus ratzonalion, and that is what draws and issues forth the divine energy to be manifested in the worlds. And here immediately we understand the relationship between the organs to the soul as a metaphor of the relationship between mitzvahs to Hashem. The organs of the body are the instruments which allow the soul to be realized in the physical universe. The body, the components of the body, the chambers of the body, the compartments of the body, the organs, sinews, bones, tissue, and so on and so forth, all aspects of the body. They are the vessels in which the soul dwells. They are the garment of the soul. The soul manifests itself and is clothed in the human body because the human body is designed, is crafted, molded in a fashion which suits the character and identity of the soul. Hence, they are the garment in which the soul clothes itself and is realized in a concrete physical body. That is the aver, that is the nature of the aver. The same is true concerning the mitzvahs. We call the 248 organs of the king. So to speak, they are the organs to Hashem, to Hashem's ratzin, to Hashem's intimate will. The performance of the mitzvahs are the garment which house, which draw forth, which bring down, which communicate Hashem's soul, Hashem's will, Hashem's inner convictions, commitments, which are the mitzvahs, into the world. The mitzvahs are the fuel, they're the garment that bring in Hashem's innermost energy and will into the world, because that is his pnimiyus haratzin. And Alter Rebbe adds, and goes on to explain, that there is something unique, however, about the nature of the relationship between an organ and a soul.